Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I'm your aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with our esteemed cohort that joins us live via podcast, if you are so inclined, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That is where you will find a link to the chat room, and you can go in there with the usual suspects. And if you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, or if there are questions you would like for us to ask, that's a great place to roll in and share that with us. And as always, if you've got take off and take care of some business, but you want to find out what you need, or you just want to get hold, it just takes a second to go over to iTunes, subscribe to the free podcast there, or any other of the podcast aggregators you need. So let's go ahead and roll into today's show. Like we promised everybody, we are going to talk today about a topic we rushed to during the course of years of mid-range. It's in that category that we love so much, the unsexy but important part of maritime power. And we're going to look at shipyards and their role in helping our maritime industrial base not only to build the Navy we have, but just importantly, maintain the ships stay in the fleet as long as we need them. And our guest Gus for the full hour will be my research assistant in the Heritage Foundation Center for National Defense. She focuses on defense industrial issues. And as a base of our discussion, we're going to bring up some of the points that she mentioned in her recent work, Naval Shipyards, Debris Lead, Revitalization, and a Rethink. You can find the link at the show page. Maya, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you.
Hey, Maya, just to kick things off, most navalists, when they decide they talk about things of importance, they want to talk ship numbers, how many of that. Why should they ask more questions to care about ships?
Well, at the Heritage Foundation, we're very concerned with the overall question of ensuring America's national defense is able to meet any challenges it does or may face. And in doing that, we look at things like ship numbers, which undoubtedly are very important, but we also look in general at the nation's ability to sustain war effort. And shipyards are a huge part of that. Really, our naval fleet is only as good as our ability to maintain it. And so just as important as ship numbers, we need to be looking at dry dock numbers, dry dock conditions, maintenance delay numbers in the nuclear fleet, and figure out a strategy to respond to those.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what the Navy shipyards consist of and what they do before we get into the gist of the piece you wrote for Heritage.
Sounds good.
So what shipyard? What do our shipyards do? How many of them are there, and what kind of condition are they in?
So the U.S. right now has four Navy shipyards, two on the East Coast, one on the West Coast of the continental United States, and one in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. And those four shipyards are responsible for all maintenance of the nuclear fleet with a few exceptions. So that's all of our aircraft carriers and submarines. they have all kinds of issues, essentially. These shipyards are very old. The oldest is Norfolk Naval Shipyard in Virginia, which has actually been in existence since before the country existed. It was founded in the 1760s. Dry docks in all four shipyards are over 100 years old. The facilities surrounding those dry docks were built for a different era of shipbuilding. You know, they weren't built at a time when there were nuclear powered ships, and as a result, they're not optimally suited to the work that they're doing now. Those are just a few issues to get started with.
Yeah, each one of those things you could do a dissertation on. But when we look at our shipyards, we have both private yards and public shipyards. What's the difference in how they service our Navy?
Yeah, so the public shipyards have the very specific mission of maintenance, not shipbuilding, and maintenance of the nuclear fleet. Private shipyards do all of the other shipyard work for the Navy. So that building of all ships, whether that's aircraft carriers, submarines, surface ships, the whole shebang, and it's also maintenance of non-nuclear ships.
What when we talk about the issues caused by the age of these shipyards, let's talk a little bit specifically about, I know you spent a lot of time on discussing dry docks. Let's talk a little bit about the dry dock issues that face the Navy right now. What are the issues, and what is the solution to some of these issues?
Absolutely. So I talked a lot about dry docks in my report because they're an issue that it's relatively straightforward to get a handle on it, in that you know, there's only so many dry docks, and they are really a choke point that limits the capacity of the four shipyards. You can only do as much maintenance work as you have shipyards for. And so the issue with the Navy shipyards, I mean, I mentioned earlier, they are all over 100 years old, or all the shipyards are. And the dry docks, for the most part, were not built for nuclear ships. A lot of them are not the correct size for the ships they're now needing to service. For example, a lot of the work that the shipyards do is on the Los Angeles-class submarine, or on attack submarines, which for decades now have been primarily Los Angeles-class submarines. And there are 17 dry docks that are able to service those Los Angeles-class submarines. Well, the Virginia-class submarine is a little bit larger than the Los Angeles class. It requires different utilities like, you know, fresh and salt water pumps and things like that. And so because of the different requirements of the ship, there are now only 12 dry docks of those 17 that can service Virginia class submarines. And then the newest, the Block 5 Virginia class submarine has the Virginia payload module, which is something that adds to the length of the submarine, adds to the water displacement of the submarine. And as a result, now there are only 7 dry docks that can service the Block 5 Virginia class submarine. So there's issues like that with the dry docks that, you know, they're not flexible. They're a piece. They're infrastructure. They're, you know, poured concrete, expensive to build, very permanent. And once they're in, they're sort of set the way they are. And so there isn't this flexibility to change as the fleet is changing. The same thing goes for aircraft carriers. The new Ford class carrier cannot be serviced by either of the two aircraft carrier dry docks, one of which is at Puget Sound and the other is at Norfolk. Both of those docks can fit the new aircraft carrier, but they don't have the utilities needed to service the carrier. So dry dock issues like that are a huge thing. In addition to simply size issues, the condition of the dry docks is also really deteriorating. Many require super flooding, which means when you put the ship into the dry dock and fill the dry dock with water, you overfill it, sometimes flooding electrical equipment and things like that in order to float a ship in that really doesn't technically fit in that dry dock. So those are just some of the issues with dry docks off the top of my head that are really driving some of these maintenance delays we see with the nuclear fleet.
You know, one thing that really caught my attention, and it's something that, you know, you read in passing, you see mentioned as a sidebar issue, but the issue with our ability to service our capital ships, not just our submarines, but our aircraft carriers. For instance, you have one place you can do it on the East Coast, one on the West Coast. And I have a question about the efficiency issue later on too, but this peacetime focus has made us, I think, forget what we know in wartime. First thing that came to mind was the British raid on Saint-Nazaire in 1942, where they took out the only Atlantic dry dock that could service the German battleship, Bismarck, and her sister. And in wartime, when you have bottlenecks like that, man, they are sexy targets. And I also I never knew that the Puget Mound dry dock is, you know, one Southern California earthquake away from sinking into the dirt. But when you're researching this, how much, if at all, did you come across discussions or concern about wartime redundancy and our ability to support that?
So those issues definitely come up, but I don't think are sufficiently high on the priority list. Honestly, it seems as if the shipyards are in such disrepair and require so much investment that the focus is really just on the Herculean effort that's required to get them up to speed to be able to maintain the current fleet. There are observances that, yes, we lack that redundancy that will be important in a wartime situation. But as far as priorities go, I don't think anyone is ready to confront the idea of constructing an additional dry dock on either the East or West Coast to service aircraft carriers. Should the Puget Sound PSYOPs plans go correctly, I think there will in the end be the potential for aircraft carrier redundancy there. But like you say, and like I mentioned in my report, it was just astonishing to read about the aircraft carrier dry dock at Puget Sound is built on a fault line and in an area where liquefaction is a huge issue, which is that in the case of an earthquake, sand mixes with water to become quicksand. It's, you know, a physics thing, and creates sinkholes that, you know, can sink entire city streets. You can Google pictures of cars in Washington that get slurped up in these sinkholes. And for one of our aircraft carriers, dry docks, not even to be a juicy target for an enemy, but to be, you know, prone to the possibility of getting sucked up in a sinkhole is something that really needs to be addressed and is just shocking to me.
Yeah, a couple of key things here. One was that you talked about the PSYOP. Can you discuss what the PSYOP is and how that plays a role in the Navy's planning for the future of these shipyards?
Yeah, absolutely. So PSIOP is the Shipyard Infrastructure Optimization Plan, and Congress required this plan from the Navy back in 2017, I believe, and that's in my notes. But the plan basically goes through everything the Navy needs to do to get the shipyard on track. The plan, thus far, they've evaluated the four shipyards to find, you know, how do we quantify what's wrong here, what's missing, and then what is our plan to address that. So they quantified it and found that of all of the scheduled planned maintenance availabilities that should happen between now and 2040, 68 of those will have to be missed due to lack of capacity, scheduling problems, the obsolescence of different equipment, and even dry docks at some of these shipyards, et cetera. So, you know, 68 maintenance availabilities is a huge problem, is a huge lack. And so their plan is incredibly thorough and goes through dry dock issues. It covers the necessary reconfiguration of facilities at the yard, and then covers capital equipment and the modernization of capital equipment that needs to happen. And their plan really is to go in and do a full kind of industrial engineering assessment of the systems at the yards, how workflows operate in the yards, and how to optimize those. And they plan to do that by modeling the yards through computer modeling, and at the end of that, figure out, you know, which buildings they need to tear down, new buildings they need to build, where different functions should be located in the yards, et cetera, all to modernize the yards and, you know, bring them into the 21st century, essentially. And so that's the plan that the Navy has proposed, and they are beginning to do that plan. The thing is such a massive overhaul is going to take years and years. I think they're slated to have it finished by about 2040. And as a result, the actions that they're doing now that are part of the plan don't necessarily look like big changes at the shipyards at this point. For example, they are doing some big things like renovating dry dock number 4 at Norfolk Navy Shipyard, and the floor of that dry dock was actually cracked, and it could no longer be used at all. And so that is being repaired. Ground broke on that project at the beginning of this year. But other big changes, like this reconfiguration of facilities, are still really in the planning stages.
One of the, lack of a better word, one of the fun things that I enjoyed about your work is it had me a chance to pull out my former Secretary of Defense Bill Perry voodoo doll and poke holes all in it again, because I remember it being an over-caffeinated and energetic lieutenant back in the 1990s when BRAC was growing on. I watched myself and others ask a bunch of questions only to be told, you know, shut up, young man. I went to MBA school for 2 weeks, so this is the efficient way to do things. But they closed down 4 shipyards at Long Beach, Charleston, Mare Island, and Philadelphia, leaving behind Norfolk, Portsmouth, Puget Sound and Pearl Harbor. And I love this little thing. This is from your article. Quote, according to the BRAC findings, these 4 yards provided considerable excess of shipyard capacity, end interquote, given the number of ships in the force structure plan, unquote. That has not aged very well, has it?
Not at all. And, you know, I wasn't following these issues at that time, but, you know, that could very well have been a reasonable assessment at the time. You know, the Cold War has ended. There's no longer, you know, this continual sort of threat from the Soviet Union. Some people believe that we've kind of reached the post, you know, the era of peace, post-war existence, whatever you want to call it. And so if I had been at the top levels of military planning at the time, I may have thought, yeah, you know, let's save some money and close a yard or two. But now, absolutely, those assessments have not aged well, especially the choice to close two shipyards on the West Coast as we, you know, pivot to the Pacific in our new national security strategy and national defense strategy. We're going to need much more capacity on the West Coast than we currently have. And now those shipyards, you know, you can't just waltz in and reopen them. They are now used for private industry. Some of them have been converted to business parks, like the Philadelphia Navy Shipyard. You can't just flip that switch back. But absolutely, I would agree that assessments made in the late 90s and early 2000s are now almost laughable as we look at how we need more Navy shipyard capacity and how difficult it will be to just create more.
Yeah, it is a sad commentary on things. I'm very, you know, I have been in shipyards at Mare Island and at Hunter's Point and in Portsmouth, Virginia, which Norfolk Naval Shipyard. And, you know, we went in for routine maintenance on surface ships, not and non-nuclear surface ships at that. So that world has changed a lot. And, you know, there were nice facilities except Hunter's Point, which I didn't like very much for different reasons. One of the problems that I was reading the GAO report from, I think it was 2017, that had to do with naval shipyards. Well, I think you referenced it in your piece. One of the problems that the GAO had and points out is the Navy really doesn't have an accurate perception or a presentation of the condition of its actual yards, because when they do their what do they call that? Facility rating, configuration rating. The default mode is that whatever is being rated is 100%, and so like 85%, I think, or maybe around that number, 70% of the facilities had ratings of 100, but we know that's not their real condition. Is that something that needs to be discussed too? I mean, I know the Navy's supposed to be working on a better system for evaluating the condition of their facilities, but that seems like a pretty enormous problem when you're not really reporting accurately the condition of how things are in the shipyards.
I would say that from what I've read, the Navy has improved its systems in the ratings I have seen of its own shipyard facilities have been pretty abysmal, which makes me think that whatever system of rating they're using must be a little more accurate. If I find those numbers, I think three of the shipyards ranked at poor, which was, I think, ratings in the high 60s, low 70s, and one actually ranked as failing. So the Navy now, by its own assessment, does see that its facilities at Navy shipyards are inadequate, to say the least.
I wanted to go back to a comment that you made earlier that just makes the already significant challenge with our aircraft carriers out in stark relief is we don't have a dry dock. I knew that the Fords were a little bit bigger than the Nimitz class carrier, but I didn't realize the margins are that thin. But if we do not have a dry dock presently at a Navy shipyard that can accommodate the Ford class, and we've got three of them in the pipeline, what's the plan? Has anybody looked at plans A, B, or C about what to do? Have you heard anything?
So my understanding from conversations with the SIOP program office is that our current aircraft carrier dry docks are big enough for the Ford class carrier, but they're not able to service it really more because of a lack of utilities at those dry docks. So the Ford class is a little bit bigger than the Nimitz class, but the bigger issue is that it requires different water levels for the saltwater and freshwater pumps. And so there's that issue. There's also different electrical needs. And so my understanding is that, you know, those to make those changes to the dry docks permanent will, you know, require a project, will require a decent amount of money. It'll take some time, but there are ways in the meantime to put temporary utilities at those dry docks, which obviously is not optimal, but makes the situation less dire than it might seem on the surface.
Well, one of the problems pointed out, and maybe in the GAO thing, is that the configuration of these shipyards, because they're so old, they've just kind of grown like Topsy, and things are put in a place because there was space to put it there, but it's not necessarily the best configuration for efficiency, and we've just been kind of putting up with that. And I understand the Navy, the SIOP, is working on a better configuration of these facilities, but one of the things they run into, ironically, for example, at Pearl Harbor Shipyard, is that many of the buildings there, because they survived the attack on Pearl Harbor, are of historical significance and may not be able to be torn down without considerable hoopla from political figures, I would guess. So how much of this stuff is being driven in addition to the Navy's need by all these other things, environmental concerns, historical concerns? How much of the problems we face with our shipyards, the Navy shipyards, are driven by concerns of these outside factors?
So I would say that this is something I touched on in my report as well, is the configuration of the shipyards as they are today, where all the facilities are and things, is, as you say, you know, kind of a result primarily of them just being very old and new facilities being added on, you know, hodgepodge as time goes on, with, you know, the result today being a kind of collection of things from all sorts of different eras. It kind of reminds me, actually, I don't know if you've spent much time in London or in old cities in Europe. You know, in American cities, often there's a grid pattern to the streets, and streets were laid out in a grid, and it, you know, makes sense and it makes life easier. In a city like London, it's been there since medieval times and earlier. And streets were just kind of made because this is the little road that gets you from the fishmonger to the candle maker. And then we add a few more roads here. And now it's just this twisty mess. And a lot of streets aren't big enough for two cars to go past each other because they were built in the time of horse-drawn carriages and all that. So I think that that is the primary issue behind the layout issues at shipyards, is, you know, this building was built back when we were still building wooden ships with sails, and this building was built in 1940 when we were surging production for World War II, and that building was built when we started building nuclear submarines and needed a way to maintain them, et cetera. But you are right to highlight the issue of the historical buildings, because that will be something that the Navy has to contend with when they begin doing these changes to its layout at the shipyards. There are buildings that are considered historical on these different, military installations, which, I mean, I'm not sure the value necessarily of preserving a historical building on a military installation where the public is not allowed to go see the building. But that issue aside, the buildings are there, and as far as I can tell, the Navy will have to work around that issue.
I want to circle back to something I mentioned in passing earlier on an hour, but it ties into what we're just talking about here, which has to do with updating. And when you look back at the shipyards that we closed back in the 90s, Long Beach, Charleston, Mare Island, and Philadelphia, especially with the emergence of China since the 1990s, and I do distinctly remember a couple of senior folks back in the 90s tapping people on the shoulder, and they said, oh, China's nothing to worry about, because all they were doing were thinking about the next fiscal year. But, you know, Long Beach, Mare Island, if the decision was made, we got the right leadership and enough buckets of borrowed money, and they said, we need additional shipyard capacity on the West Coast to support Pacific operations. I know it's hard, it's difficult, but how close to impossible would it be to reclaim and repurpose those two locations? Because, and being from California, you know this, California has most of the West Coast and most of the good harbors there. But it's almost impossible to build any type of new industry there for all the regulations and red tape, et cetera, and so forth. But the future is calling defense issues on the West Coast. You know, what are the options to expand capacity to support the Pacific?
Well, that's a good question. And as you highlight, it's certainly a tough question. Real estate in California is expensive. Especially coastal real estate is especially expensive. Environmental regulations are about as strict as they can be. There's a lot of headwinds there. But, you know, as you say, this is going to be kind of the area of focus in coming years. To look specifically at Mare Island and Long Beach, both of those still have some of their facilities, their dry docks, in existence. You know, you can go on Google Maps and look up those places and see the dry docks, you know, in satellite imagery. They're there. But it would be very difficult to repurpose those as Navy shipyards, and in fact it's hard to say. My guess would be that it would be easier to just buy land and build a shipyard from scratch. But at Long Beach, there's currently a lot of commercial shipping through there. That shipyard is owned by commercial interests. Mare Island, I'm not as certain that there's a big commercial presence there. You actually can go and take tours of the, you know, historic Navy shipyard there. Because things have just been sitting for so long, I would imagine they're almost in too much disrepair to be fixed. If you think that the problems that are for current Navy shipyards are bad, imagine trying to rehabilitate a shipyard that sat vacant for 20 or 30 years. So there's this need for a West Coast, increased shipyard capacity, but it's going to be uphill work, and it really would take the insight of someone in the Navy who understands what resources are available there to know what could be done in future.
Well, it is not just the problem of physical locations, but we have workforce limitations. I think you point out that the numbers of people who are experienced enough in each one of these shipyards to mentor younger people is pretty limited and probably growing more limited as time passes. Are you aware of any efforts to work together with the various unions and other entities to develop a labor force that we can use in these shipyards that do exist, and also expand if we expanded to another shipyard someplace else?
Yes, I know that the Navy is actively engaged trying to recruit skilled labor to its Navy shipyards. I was actually reading about Navy officials going to places like Mississippi to Biloxi and holding career fairs at high schools there, trying to recruit workers for the shipyard in Virginia. So they, you know, are traveling afield as well as looking in local areas for that talent, that skilled labor that can do the work on submarines and aircraft carriers. And, you know, the Gulf Coast has a good amount of private shipyards, private shipbuilding, and so that skill set kind of exists there, and I know the Navy looks to that region and to others with commercial and private shipbuilding to potentially find skilled workers for the public shipyards. An issue, though, really is just that the entire shipbuilding industrial base in the United States has contracted over the years. You know, we talk about competition with China. China is the number one builder of ships in the world on the commercial side. And then, you know, they have this policy of civil-military fusion so that those shipbuilding skills that have been allowed to grow by their success in the commercial space also feed their ability to build their Navy. And the United States just doesn't have that. We have our private shipbuilders, but a lot of them exist as government contractors. You have General Dynamics Electric Boat, and you have Huntington Ingalls, Newport News, and, you know, these different companies. They're really looking for Navy contracts, and it's just a very different structure from what shipbuilding looks like in other countries. So while the Navy can be looking to recruit skilled workers for the public shipyards, it's a struggle to recruit workers for any shipyards just because it's an industry that's been shrinking over the last 20 years. And as a result, like I talked about, the public yards, there's fewer skilled workers or senior, more experienced workers to train and mentor more junior ones, which can lead to mistakes and accidents. You know, there's just a whole host of problems from that, even though now that we're kind of reentering this era of great power competition, there is demand for those skills. It's just harder to come by them because of these different market forces.
I have a regular question that I ask guests when I reach the point that I want to throw something against the wall in anger. But I think what's so frustrating for myself and a lot of folks when we get to the point of talking about shipyard condition, qualified people who are trained in these trades. Now, you just mentioned China. Well within my adulthood life, what are now these world-beating shipyards, many of which, for instance, their largest crane was bought from a shipyard in Jacksonville, Florida, and shipped over there in the 1990s. But China's world-beating shipyards were just a couple of decades ago mostly marsh and swamp. The highly technical shipyard workers, their fathers, and some of them were peasants who worked the soil with no tools, walked to work, if that. When you look at Germany and Japan, those beautiful shipyards, within the edges of living memory, Kiel, Hamburg, Yokohama, all those shipyards were bombed into rubble, and most of their skilled artisans were killed during World War II. South Korea, very much like China, where by the end of the Korean War, marshes, swamp, devastation. Your average South Korean had a lower standard of living than your average North Korean. Yet here we find ourselves, a nation of 330 million people, not being able to compete with these countries. And I look at who are ultimately, and somebody who's at a think tank in D.C., you see this every day in much better detail than I do. Nothing can happen or will happen until you have the right advocates in Congress who have their levers on power, which means money, and the vision to understand how to help steer things. Who do you, are you aware of, should people look towards in Congress that get this issue and can help educate their colleagues and others on the importance of putting some type of national effort towards this? It can be done. Other nations have done greater things with less resources.
Absolutely. I really appreciate your, you know, historical background on global shipbuilding. That was some interesting stuff that I hadn't come across before. I should preface by saying that the Heritage Foundation does policy and not politics. We don't pick our favorites in Congress, but we can look at those who we think have the right idea. In general, I would say that Congress does understand this issue, and Congress very much understands the value of trade skills to the U.S. economy and the value of trade skills to U.S. national security. In different hearings I've been to, congressmen and senators on both sides of the aisle have really been focused on figuring out how shipyards can play into the economies of their districts and their states, how high schools can promote, trade career fairs as well as college fairs, how to reverse this sort of almost stigma that's developed around careers in trade as opposed to, you know, the four-year degree college route, which isn't for everyone and shouldn't be for everyone. I know basically any congressman who has a shipyard in their state or their district is on it with these issues, knows the value of those trade skills, knows the importance of recruiting people into those programs. And there really also is a huge effort on the part of private industry to get those skills developed because, you know, they need it to be able to continue operating. There's a profit involved in being able to have the right workers doing a good job building their products. For example, I was able to go down and visit Austal Shipyard down in Mobile, Alabama, and they build the littoral combat ship as well as some other ships for the U.S. Navy. And they showed us they have a whole program to train new workers from scratch, essentially. And it's, if I remember correctly, it's free to enroll in the program. You learn to be a welder, an electrician, whichever, and then are employed there at the shipyard or have the option to go down the way to Huntington Ingalls in Pascagoula, Mississippi, or you know, you could move and go work at a shipyard. So private industry, I think, has a big role to play in this as well as Congress.
One of the there's a paragraph that you wrote that I really thought was interesting. It says a potential challenge to implementing the PSYOP is its reliance on just-in-time funding. The plan is very precisely timed. Dry docks are required just in time to meet a new wave of scheduled ship availabilities. Funding is obtained just in time to perform these dry dock repairs. The completion of one project allows another to begin, and so forth. Talk a little bit about the problems by not funding whatever the Navy needs to fix these shipyards on a long-term basis instead of this just-in-time funding. Talk about the problems that causes, please.
So basically the way the PSYOP is set up now, each year there are certain projects that will need to be done kind of based on a schedule that in some cases is already laid out. For example, the PSYOP already contains a plan for which year certain dry docks will be either renovated or altered or, you know, fixed up in different ways. And, you know, they already know that, you know, this dry dock will be reconstructed in fiscal year 2027, and we estimate it will require this amount of funds, and we'll be getting those from MILCON funding. There are other parts of the PSYOP, like the facilities reconfiguration, that they don't know what the timeline for that project is because they're still in the modeling stage. But either way, basically each year they'll have to go back to Congress and say, this is what we're going to be doing next year. This is how much it's going to cost. You know, can we please have this? And not only will they have to go to Congress, but there will also be the internal budget discussion within the Navy and within the Department of Defense. So all that will have to happen each time. And if one year that flips, then a project flips. If a dry dock that was supposed to be renovated in year 2027 now has to be renovated in 2029, that can create an entire ripple effect that ripples through the entire maintenance schedule for the nuclear fleet because, you know, the USS Virginia can't be serviced and therefore it will be getting its maintenance availability 2 years late. So then the following thing that was supposed to be docked there will be late or will have to be moved to another dry dock where that project will be late and on and on and on. So that's kind of the problem that would arise there. There potentially are other ways to fund the PSYOP. Basically any sort of exceptional funding structure that's out of the normal congressional process, you know, of the NDAA and the traditional budget request appropriations process that happens each year. Anything out of the ordinary is very difficult to get and is unusual for it to happen. So for the Navy to say in the PSYOP, as they kind of do, that, you know, this will require a special appropriations authority, you know, that's kind of you can't count on having a special appropriations authority because it's very rare for Congress to grant that. So really the Navy has to, until they come up with a better solution and can get buy-in from Congress on it, they should count on having to use the regular budgeting process, in which case they could really have this vulnerability where a delay in one project causes a delay in another, suddenly causes, you know, the entire maintenance schedule to begin to unravel.
Yeah, you got to kind of laugh at that. It's kind of like figuring out what you're going to do for the next few years. Like, well, I'm going to have a rich uncle die who will give me a bunch of money. Then I'll take my big European vacation. And you go, which rich uncle? Oh, I don't know, but I'm sure there's one out there. It's bizarre. And the whole, I also You have to have a dark sense of humor when people talk about in the out years are, well, this will go from 27 to 29. You can almost hear inner dialogue about, well, that'll be on somebody else's watch. I'll be gone by then. They'll figure it out later. But I just want this approved today. Will you sign, please? But there are very real-world consequences where occasionally you can only have, you can only get lucky so often. You can only do, eventually you run out of duct tape and baling wire, and you have a very real-world consequences to this exquisitely timed maintenance availabilities. If you could, I believe you mentioned it in part of an answer earlier on in the show, but for the listeners who might not be familiar with the saga of the USS Boise, describe that for a second and how that informs the discussions we've had about serviceability.
So the poor USS Boise went in for its, a routine maintenance availability. And there was no dry dock available for it to be, receive its servicing. And so it sat waiting for a dry dock for at least 2 years. Trying to find it in my notes to get all the details because it really is just amazing. Yes, so it came in for its maintenance period in 2013, but then maintenance had to be deferred because there was no dry dock available for it to be serviced. It then had to stop its normal operations in 2016 because at a certain point, if a submarine hasn't received the maintenance it needs, it's no longer certified to submerge because, it's not safe anymore. And so in 2016, it had to stop its normal operations and just sat idle. And it sat for over 2 years. And finally, there still was nowhere in a public shipyard for it to be serviced, and it had to be sent to a private shipyard to begin its overhaul. So, the rule of thumb is that maintenance of nuclear ships and submarines happens in public shipyards. Well, in some cases, the Navy has had to send that work to privately owned shipyards that are able to do nuclear work, which has a lot of problems in itself because those shipyards are used to ship building, not ship maintenance. And those are two different skills. So the Boise arrived at the private shipyard and then continued to experience delays to its maintenance once there because the shipyard it was at was not used to doing submarine maintenance. So the poor USS Boise, I think, has finished its overhaul, but honestly, it may still be maintained, and it was due to begin its maintenance in 2013. So that really is just shocking.
Yeah, I think both you and the GAO point out that it's not just a matter of a ship like the Boise being delayed, which means we've spent billions of dollars on a ship which we're not using, but this is these issues with the shipyards and the delays that are caused by the inefficiencies and other issues with them has affected the availability of the Navy. I mean, we don't have all our ships all the time. We don't have the force we're supposed to have because we can't get the maintenance done that's required for our ships. Can you talk? I don't remember what the numbers are, but can you kind of talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially, if a ship requires maintenance and doesn't receive it, the ship, after a certain point, can't continue its normal operations. And, in the past 20 years or so, since there were all of those shipyard closures, the philosophy seems to be, you know, if its maintenance is delayed, you know, oh no, its maintenance is delayed. But there's no, you know, impending threat that we're all afraid of, that we need to make sure that we're all ready to go and every ship is receiving its maintenance on time and, you know, this is peacetime. We have the flexibility to delay a maintenance period or two. But you have the combination now of all those delays are starting to add up to an insurmountable problem. And at the same time, we're no longer in this sort of peacetime, not worried about anything. Instead, we're returning to great power competition. China now has, from our intelligence, we believe China has more ships ready for operations than the United States does. I think they're at around 350 estimated, and we are currently at 293 ships total. And so you have this simultaneous, oh no, now we need those ships to be ready, and also we've left this problem for so long that we can't get ready.
Yeah, I found the quote in your piece. It says, the GAO reported that between 2008 and 2018, attack submarines spent a total of 61 months idle while awaiting to enter dry docks for depot-level maintenance. Because of this idle time and depot maintenance delays, the Navy spent approximately $1.5 billion on attack submarines, provided zero operational capability. I mean, I'm surprised that hasn't been a banner. Well, of course, it's this is a department of things that nobody knows about, but I'm surprised that hadn't been a banner headline in newspapers and you know, because that sounds like a scandal that we were spending all this money on ships and we're not being able to use them.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, getting back to the first question of the interview where, you know, everyone is very concerned with ship numbers. Well, the number of ships you have really depends on your ability to maintain them because, you know, the prospect of buying, you know, the question, do we need 9 new Virginia-class submarines or should we add a 10th? You know, all these different questions about how many submarines, how many of any ship has to be compared with, are they going to be able to be maintained and operational? Because, you know, a 10th submarine would be lovely, but if it's a 10th submarine that's sitting idle pier side waiting for a dry dock, that really is just a very expensive, you know, piece of metal sitting out in the ocean. And we certainly can't afford that as a nation and as a military, and it'll take a serious fix to our maintenance structure to stop that from happening.
Yeah, I know this kind of touches on the political side, but it has real implications. I think we both can see, you know, kind of what you and Mark were talking about is we're spending billions of dollars on submarines that can't deploy. And if we look at the surface side of the house, you have all these LCS that can't deploy. And somewhere out there, there's a politician who really could make some hay by just airing all the Navy's dirty laundry until we can fix it. It's just, it's a sad, sad business. But fear and shame are great motivators. And Maya, I think the work that you did here and the work that other people are doing, hopefully, can build a critical mass that enough people become aware of this challenge, because it is fixable. It just takes leadership, will, and a lot of money, but it is fixable. And as we approach the end of the hour, what are you working on next? And if people would like to keep an eye on things that you're publishing and putting your name to, what's a good way for them to track that?
Well, for things I'm up to next, actually on the topic of shipyards, on September 30th, the Heritage Foundation will be hosting a webinar that's open to the public on the state of U.S. Navy shipyards, and Diana Marr from the Government Accountability Office, the GAO, will be a speaker, and she's written numerous reports on Navy shipyards, and we also have Congressman Rob Whitman from Virginia giving keynote remarks at that. So, again, that's on September 30th. You can find the information at heritage.org, and that'll provide some great perspective from two people who both care a lot about this issue and come at it from different directions, and will be hosted by Brent Sadler, who's Heritage's main Navy guy. He's our senior fellow for naval warfare and emerging technologies or something. And as for future issues, my portfolio includes the entire defense industrial base. Something I'm interested in looking at going forward is the state of defense supply chains and vulnerabilities to our supply chains. So you may see an occasional op-ed on that topic, on this topic, and on any other emerging issues as they arise. But anyone who's interested in reading my work can find it on the heritage.org website.
Perfect. And Maya, again, it's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed the hour, and I appreciate you taking time out of your afternoon to join us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was a pleasure having you. Thank you.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. And until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell.